Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Marjorie Cohn, past president of the National Lawyers Guild and legal scholar, who examines the mounting evidence indicating that President Trump may be guilty of obstructing justice. Kathy Kelly of the group Voices for Creative Nonviolence, who assesses the death and destruction in Yemen's forgotten civil war, exacerbated by Saudi intervention in U.S. arms. And Matt Remley, a member of the Lakota Nation, who discusses the grassroots indigenous campaign targeting banks funding the Dakota Access Pipeline and four other tar sands crude oil pipelines originating in Alberta, Canada. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Outrage exploded over the murder of award-winning Mexican journalist Javier Valdez, only a block from his newspaper office in the state of Sinaloa. This is a region dominated by drug kingpin Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, who was extradited to the United States in January. Valdez ran the weekly newspaper Rio Doce and was a vocal critic of the drug cartels and their persistent targeting of Mexican journalists. In 2011, he won the Committee to Protect Journalists Press Freedom Award. The New York-based group had recently met with Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto, seeking protections for journalists covering Mexico's drug war. After the murder, two Mexican news outlets, Animal Politico and Tercera Vía, suspended publication for one day. Before he was killed, Valdez told the press freedom group Index on Censorship that a grenade had been thrown into his office in 2009, and he'd received numerous death threats from the drug cartels. The crusading journalist insisted that sources have been killed or disappeared, and the government doesn't care and does nothing to protect them. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, over 50 reporters have been killed or disappeared in Mexico since 2010. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents have arrested over 41,000 suspects since President Trump signed an executive order in late January, expanding the power of ICE agents to deport migrants. Acting Director of ICE Thomas Homan declared there are no enforcement limits protecting undocumented migrants. The Trump executive order not only allows ICE agents to arrest those convicted of a crime, but also residents suspected of having committed a chargeable criminal offense. According to the Los Angeles Times, more than 8 million U.S. residents are now classified by the government as high priority for deportation, more than four times the number in that status under the Obama administration. The surge in ICE arrests comes as Trump's high-profile border wall with Mexico has stalled in Congress, and the Muslim travel ban is tied up in federal courts. According to ICE's own data, 10,000 immigrants have been arrested for simply entering the United States illegally, more than double the number charged for this offense 1 year ago. Many police departments have refused to allow ICE agents to enter local jails, asserting that their policy would seriously damage relations with local immigrant communities. As a result, ICE is now engaged in more aggressive street patrols at courthouses and schools. In 2012, arch-conservative governor of Kansas, Sam Brownback, instituted tax cuts designed by supply-side guru Arthur Laffer that were supposed to pay for themselves. But the tax cuts, similar to those proposed by President Trump, forced deep cuts in the state's basic services. Deficits have now jeopardized the viability of the Kansas public school system, resulting in a $500 million shortfall this year. A key element of the Brownback tax cut plan was to slash taxes paid by limited liability corporations and pass-through businesses. Many independent businesses now pay no state taxes. The false hope was that the businesses would invest their tax savings in creating new jobs, but job creation in Kansas today lags behind neighboring states. Former Kansas Secretary of Administration Dwayne Goosen told The Guardian, "There is no evidence whatsoever that suggests this plan works." The Kansas Supreme Court has ruled that the state has underfunded schools by hundreds of millions of dollars annually. Class sizes have increased, teachers have not been replaced, and arts and music programs have been eliminated. Parents who moved to Kansas for their once excellent schools now complain about the chronic education cuts and deteriorating quality. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
As Donald Trump embarked on his first overseas trip as president, new bombshell revelations deepened his administration's escalating crisis. While some Republican legislators welcomed the news that Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein had appointed former FBI Director Robert Mueller as special counsel to investigate charges of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia's attempt to influence the outcome of the 2016 U.S. presidential election, a hoped-for period of calm never arrived. The Washington Post reported on May 22nd that President Trump had asked Director of National Intelligence Daniel Coats and Admiral Michael Rogers, Director of the National Security Agency, to publicly deny the existence of any evidence of coordination between Trump's campaign and Moscow during the 2016 election. This news, on top of earlier revelations that President Trump had urged former FBI Director James Comey to pledge his loyalty and to end his investigation of Trump's fired National Security Advisor Mike Flynn, confirms a pattern of behavior consistent with a president attempting to obstruct justice. Evidence of an apparent White House cover-up was amplified in an earlier New York Times story that reported Trump had told Russian officials in a May 10th Oval Office meeting that his dismissal of FBI Director James Comey had relieved great pressure on him, describing Comey as crazy, a real nutjob. Your reporter spoke with Marjorie Cohn, past president of the National Lawyers Guild and legal scholar, who examines the mounting evidence indicating that President Trump may be guilty of obstructing justice in the Russia probe, an impeachable offense.
By appointing Mueller, Rosenstein has given political cover to the Republicans, many of whom are very upset about what's happening with Trump, but are worried that if they distance themselves from him too much, that might impact their chances in the midterm elections in 2018. The problem is that Robert Mueller can be fired by Rosenstein if Trump orders Rosenstein to fire him, because he serves at the pleasure of the executive branch, because we don't have the independent counsel statute where three judges appointed the special counsel. So the charge that Mueller has is to investigate any links between the Russian government and the campaign of Donald Trump, and any matters that arose or may arise directly from the investigation. And that includes an alleged cover-up. So at this point, there is circumstantial evidence of improper conduct between members of the Trump administration and Russian operatives during the presidential campaign, but we have seen no concrete proof of criminal conduct. But the evidence of a cover-up continues to mount. Trump has admitted that the Russia investigation motivated him to fire FBI Director James Comey. Trump asked Comey to end the investigation of former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. Trump made veiled threats to Comey about possible tapes of their conversations. Trump demanded that Comey pledge loyalty to him, but Comey refused. And Trump defensively fixated on Comey telling him three times that Trump was not an object of the investigation. Now, two more possible indications of cover-up came out. Turns out that in March, Trump asked the director of National Intelligence, Coates, and the director of the NSA, Rogers, to deny any collusion between Russia and the Trump administration, and both refused. So these two developments also add to the case for obstruction of justice. And obstruction of justice is basically requires that a person corruptly or by use of threats obstructs, impedes, or endeavors to influence, obstruct, or impede a congressional investigation, a criminal investigation, an investigation by a department or agency of the U.S., or a federal court proceeding. But in order to be found guilty of obstruction of justice, a person has to act with an improper purpose. That's the corruptly part of the statute. And before Trump asked Comey to drop the investigation of Flynn, he was in the Oval Office. The two of them were in the Oval Office with Vice President Pence and Attorney General Sessions, and Trump asked Pence and Sessions to step out of the Oval Office before Trump asked Comey to drop the investigation of Flynn. That could be evidence of an improper purpose.
Many comparisons to Watergate have been made with the recent revelations about Trump's alleged obstruction of justice and a lot of the other scandals plaguing his administration. But certainly a big difference is that we have a one-party state now. Both houses of Congress are run by Republicans, the party of Trump, as is the Supreme Court. They have a working majority on the Supreme Court now, the Republicans do. So if the Republican House of Representatives doesn't initiate impeachment proceedings and the country at large feels strongly that that should be the course of action, what is the recourse of citizens? Militant protest? Are we talking about a constitutional crisis if Republicans refuse to follow the Constitution and initiate proceedings to prosecute high crimes and misdemeanors?
Well, I think that the same way that constituents of Republican congresspersons packed their offices, packed their town halls, protested, will be done if Congress does not do what people think it should do. And again, in 2018, these Congress people are up for re-election, and they're going to have to answer to their constituents. So even though, yes, the House is controlled by the Republicans, that does not mean necessarily that they're not going to react to demands from their constituents to pursue this just because they control the House. Now, I don't know that he would actually, even if he was impeached in the House of Representatives, that he would actually be convicted in the Senate by two-thirds. I think that that's more of a long shot, but, you know, there are some Senate seats open as well, or up for grabs, I should say, as well in 2018. We don't know what's going to happen, and Trump is going to fight it tooth and nail if he doesn't melt down before. You know, it's very, very hard to predict what's going to happen, but I guess you could say it's as fascinating as it is frightening.
That was Marjorie Cohn, past president of the National Lawyers Guild and legal scholar. Her book, Drones and Targeted Killings, will be published in a second edition at the end of May. Find more commentary and analysis on the scandals surrounding Donald Trump's presidency by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As the civil war in the impoverished nation of Yemen entered its third year in March, few Americans are aware of the death and destruction falling heavily on civilians and their own nation's involvement in the conflict. The combatants engaged in the war are the Houthis, an armed group whose members belong to a branch of Shia Islam known as Zaydism. The Houthis are allied with supporters of Yemen's former dictator, Ali Abdullah Saleh, and are alleged to be receiving arms from Iran. On the other side are forces allied with the current president, Mansour Hadi, supported by a Saudi Arabian-led coalition. According to the UN, nearly 5,000 civilians have died, and more than 8,000 have been wounded since the conflict began, the majority killed by Saudi-led airstrikes. Combatants blocking critical food supplies threatens famine, and an outbreak of cholera that has spread to more than 30,000 is expected to deepen Yemen's humanitarian crisis. International human rights groups maintain that horrific abuses and war crimes are being committed throughout Yemen, including Saudi airstrikes that have unlawfully targeted schools, hospitals, homes, markets, and mosques. The human rights community has condemned the arms deal President Trump recently signed with the Saudi monarchy, worth $110 billion. Your reporter spoke with Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of the group Voices for Creative Nonviolence, who discusses the death and destruction in Yemen's forgotten civil war exacerbated by Saudi intervention and U.S. arms.
Some people who were aware of our efforts to go to Iraq and bring food and medicines, mostly medicines, to Iraqi children and families when Iraq was under economic sanctions, have been helping us better understand what's happening now in Yemen, where the country is experiencing a naval blockade while they have been so dependent on food in particular that would come through the port of Hodeidah. And now, when they've experienced so many bombings, indiscriminate bombings of hospitals and clinics, as the Saudis have used United States weapons sold during 2015 to the Saudis to attack hospitals, roadways, including, you know, buses that are on roadways, and civilian gatherings, including weddings. And, you know, they've undergone so much terror and fear already in Yemen, and now they're facing starvation and an outbreak of cholera and a very likely imminent bombing of their major port city of Hodeidah. So people who knew what we were doing in Iraq have said, you know, maybe we can help you to now focus on what's happening in Yemen, because it's a place that is so very, very forgotten. President Trump was in Saudi Arabia negotiating a deal with the Saudis such that the Saudis would invest maybe as much as $40 billion or more in United States infrastructure, and people in the United States would get jobs if they're working for weapon makers, and the United States would give $100 billion of weapons to Saudi Arabia, and then the Saudis said, and we're going to try to help stop terrorist attacks. But it's such a conundrum, because really the Saudis have been supporting people who've been waging terrifying attacks in the neighboring country of Yemen. And also they're teamed up with the Al-Qaeda in the Arab Peninsula, and supplying groups with more weapons is somehow going to lessen terror, and enabling aerial terrorist attacks would somehow bring peace. It's just so unthinkable.
Kathy, we only have about a minute or two left, but I would ask you to briefly provide our listeners with some ideas of what they can do here in the United States to get some attention on the conflict in Yemen, the U.S. role in that conflict, and what we as people could advocate for stopping the carnage.
Well, Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy, who has repeatedly, and at some risk, I would imagine, to his own political future, spoken out about Yemen and about Saudi Arabia, and he has managed to get 27 co-signers to Senate Joint Resolution 40. And that's a resolution that says that weapons cannot be sent to Saudi Arabia while Saudis continue to indiscriminately bomb Yemen and to abuse human rights of people in other countries, but violating international laws. So Senator Murphy, I think, would welcome more support. People can certainly tell their friends and relatives in other states to support Resolution 40, and then also get every single congressperson on board to be part of introducing a similar bill into the Congress, and also joining 55 congresspeople who've said that the United States can't continue to be complicit with the Saudi war without going to Congress and getting authorization. I'm not so sanguine about that one, because I'm afraid with the current makeup of our Congress and Senate, they might get that authorization. So we should say to ourselves as individuals, we won't authorize war. We'll do everything we can to resist it. And, of course, education. These realities that people are experiencing in Yemen, this alarming outbreak of cholera, the bombing of the port city, the indiscriminate bombing of civilian areas, all of this should be part of our mainstream news coverage. And I think with Senator Chris Murphy speaking as eloquently and clearly as he has in Connecticut, you have a chance to push this word out further and further into every possible kind of media. It's interesting that Iran is so vilified, but they did just elect someone who's not a hardliner. Rouhani is a moderate, and he was just elected. And he's now being told, well, you're going to be shut out because you're Shia, and We believe that somehow your country is responsible for terrorism in the world. But I think that doesn't cohere with the truth. You can't even find pictures or intercepts of phone calls that would give evidence that the Iranians have been arming the Houthi rebels. I mean, I'm not saying that they haven't, but there isn't the evidence. And there's so much evidence of the tens of billions and now soon to be hundreds of billions of dollars of weapons that the United States has sold to Saudi Arabia.
That was Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of the group Voices for Creative Nonviolence. For more analysis on the war in Yemen and the U.S. and Saudi role in the conflict, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Earlier this month, a coalition of grassroots indigenous groups from across North America, what they call Turtle Island, joined with more than 100 indigenous nations and tribes in Canada that are members of the Treaty Alliance Against Tar Sands Expansion to launch a new integrated divestment campaign. Their targets are the banks funding the Dakota Access Pipeline and four other tar sands crude oil pipelines currently proposed to run from Alberta, Canada, to other regions in Canada, and to the U.S. The targeted pipelines include the Keystone XL pipeline, which was killed by former President Obama, but revived by Donald Trump. The campaign grew out of earlier organizing against the Keystone XL and the successful campaign in Seattle to force the city to divest from Wells Fargo Bank, a large investor in the Dakota Access Pipeline, other oil pipelines, and socially destructive investments such as private prisons. Thus far, the revived KXL pipeline has not secured any project-level loans. Under Indigenous leadership, other groups including Rainforest Action Network and a Canadian affiliate of 350.org are also supporting the multi-pronged effort. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Matt Remley, a member of the Lakota Nation living in Seattle, who worked on the successful city council divestment resolution and a second resolution that passed prohibiting banks that financed tar sands pipelines from bidding on City of Seattle contracts. Remley, who is a founder and editor of Last Real Indians, an online news site, talks about applying the lessons of previous struggles to this new divestment campaign.
One of our strategies with Wells Fargo and the divestment campaign we ran there was kind of twofold. One, the campaign was never about just stopping with the City of Seattle, but expanding. We wanted to expand to other cities and tribes in terms of getting them to also do divestment efforts. So we worked early on with organizers in San Francisco, L.A., and other places around the country and internationally to run similar divestment campaigns. So that was one part of the strategy. The second part, as you know, when Trump issued his executive order, it gave the green light again for the Keystone XL pipeline. So we wanted to be proactive, and we crafted another piece of legislation resolution to take back to the Seattle City Council that said if any bank gives money to TransCanada, project-level loans to TransCanada to build the Keystone XL pipeline or any of these other tar sands pipelines, then they would be excluded from bidding on City of Seattle contracts. And that resolution was passed, and that it expanded out to the other tar sands pipelines as well. And then we linked up with some other organizations, including Indigenous Environmental Network, Honor the Earth, the International Indigenous Youth Council, and decided to kind of make it a joint effort, which includes tribal communities located in and around the tar sands, make a global effort to get a lot of places to run divestment campaigns against those pipelines.
Matt Remley. Often, when groups start a boycott of soft drinks or cigarettes or whatever, The common wisdom is that you target one, usually the industry leader, and go after them, because if you're spread too thin, you're less likely to have success with any of them. What do you think about that argument as it relates to your coalition going after all these banks?
Actually, I would disagree. I mean, and also, I mean, a boycott's different than a, you know, a divestment campaign, in the sense, especially when you're looking at the financial institutions. So, you know, this is something we thought about real strategically when we crafted our ordinance in Seattle to divest from Wells Fargo. So to us, you know, Wells Fargo was one of the main banks behind DAPL, and they had a number of City of Seattle contracts. What we didn't want to see happen was for the City of Seattle to divest its $3 billion in Wells Fargo and then reinvest in a Bank of America or whomever, because that in itself wouldn't be a victory, because all the banks are, you know, got their hands dirty or involvement in some of these pipelines. So when we crafted our ordinance, we were very conscious of that. What we crafted in legislation were this whole set of criteria that we call socially responsible banking practices. That includes things like banks not being engaged in predatory lending practices, not invested in energy-intensive fossil fuel projects or private prisons. So what that means is when a bank bids on a City of Seattle contract, they're scored and there's points associated with it. So banks will be dinged, you know, if they are investing in private prisons or, you know, fossil fuel projects, they're going to be dinged, therefore less likely to be able to bid on City of Seattle contracts. We strengthened that by passing that next resolution, which excludes any bank from bidding on City of Seattle contracts if they are to give project-level loans or investment into any of these TARSAC campaigns.
That was Matt Remley with the campaign to defund proposed tar sands pipelines originating in Alberta, Canada. Learn more about this new divestment campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KOWA in Olympia, Washington, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray, and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.